Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
All right. Well, hello and welcome to today's event at the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Stephen Saum, and I'm the editor of Worldview Magazine. This program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Future of Democracy series, supported by Betsy and Roy Eisenhart. Other programs in the series can be found on the club's website at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm very pleased to be joined this evening by Dr. Yasha Monk to discuss his latest book, The Great Experiment, Why Diverse Democracies Fall Apart and How They Can Endure. Dr. Monk is a political scientist, author, and associate professor of practice at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. His works have included assessments of American democracy, the dangers of nationalism, and ethnic relations in democratic settings. In his latest book, The Great Experiment, Yasha Monk explains that the challenge faced by modern democracies to be both diverse and equal is one that is historically unprecedented. Using historical analysis and in-depth political knowledge, Dr. Monk contends that while democracies in the past have either fallen short, when it comes to equality or diversity, there are actions we can take today that will help our institutions achieve this. Finally, he argues that this is not only possible, but essential to the survival of a free society. A reminder to our audience, if you're here with us in person in San Francisco and have a question for Yasha Monk, please write it on the question cards in your seat, near your seats. If you're watching along with us online, please put your questions into the text chat on YouTube. We'll be getting to audience questions later in the program. So thank you, Yasha Monk, for joining us here in San Francisco this evening. So the title of your book, and the origin story of it comes out of an interesting moment that you had in a previous conversation where you found yourself very much under fire for something that you'd said. Tell us that story. How did that come about?
Yeah, first of all, thank you for having me. This is such a wonderful venue, and I look forward to this conversation. And yeah, I thought that, you know, the experience of writing a book is always the experience of being misunderstood. So I thought perhaps I'll start the book with the most extreme story of being misunderstood that's happened to me so far. And so about 4 years ago, I was in Germany promoting my last book, The People Versus Democracy, which is about the rise of populism and the threat it poses to democracies around the world. I went on one of the biggest news shows in German television. And I was a little bit nervous because I'm used to speaking about politics in English at this point. I grew up in Germany, but I haven't really done academic work there since high school, so I always feel sort of a little bit like a kid trying to talk about politics in German. The first question was about the causes of a rise of populism, and I thought I can answer that, and I was getting less nervous as I was speaking, and I said, it has to do with the stagnation of living standards for ordinary citizens, has to do with the rise of the internet and of social media. But there's also a third kind of reason, which is the transformation of monoethnic and monocultural societies like Germany into more multi-ethnic ones. I think that that can succeed and it will succeed in the end, but it also poses some very serious challenges. And so what we're doing here is a sort of historically unique experiment. I finished the interview. My mom, who usually dislikes every interview I give, called me up and said, well done, that was really good. Okay, fine. I went to sleep. I took a plane to the United States, so I didn't look at my phone for a long time. And then when I landed, I switched on my phone, and I had just these, dozens and dozens of messages denouncing me and saying, how dare you experiment on the German people? And I thought, what do you mean I'm experimenting on the German people? What is this actually about? And I Googled myself, and it turned out that these far-right sort of websites and blogs and politicians said that I had somehow admitted that Angela Merkel and I were in cahoots to experiment on the German people by replacing essentially the German population with a more pliable population. And that was a misunderstanding because it misunderstood what I meant by experiment, mm-hmm. right? So there's an experiment which is what sort of your chemistry teacher does in ninth grade, right? Who comes in, he has two liquids, and he pours one to the other, and there's an explosion, and he knows exactly what's going to happen, and then he explains the principles behind it, right? And it's all sort of set up with the outcome very much known in advance, hopefully, otherwise the school might burn down. But what I meant by experiment is what the framers of our constitution meant in the late 18th century, namely, when you are in a new situation, you didn't quite choose to get into that situation. In many ways, it is the unintended consequence of other kinds of decisions that people made. You're trying to do something novel, and you don't quite know how that's going to work, but you realize that you have to make it work. And that's the situation we're in today, because you have two kinds of democracies. You have ones like Germany that were founded at a moment when they were very homogeneous. And you have ones like the United States that always have been diverse, but which used to exclude big parts of the population from participation, in fact, exclude and dominate and subjugate parts of the population in the most heinous ways. And so what's truly novel in both places is the attempt to build ethnically and religiously diverse democracies but actually treat their members as true equals. And that's the subject of this book.
And yet it seems strange to be talking about an experiment, you know, when there has been democracy in some form in this country, right, going on 250 years now.
Yeah, so, I mean, democracy was an experiment from the late 18th century because there was actually no precedent for making the self-governing republics work. That was the concern of the founders, that every attempt at building the self-governing republics until that time had failed, and they didn't know what was going to succeed. I do think we're now at a new kind of experiment, because mm-hmm. throughout those 250 years, you did, you know, the challenge of ethnic and religious diversity was solved by simply saying one group is going to have power and it's going to have full membership in the nation, it's going to have the ability to fully participate politically, and the others will be excluded. And so what's new about the situation in the United States today is not that America is diverse for the first time in its history. It has been that since certainly the founding of a republic. But it is that we are actually trying to treat members of so many different ethnic and religious groups as equals. And of course, the share of the non-white population has also gone up significantly. And so you put those two things together, and I do think that we're doing something that is unprecedented and that qualifies as the kind of second-grade experiment in American history.
And then there are the kind of the two parts of the book. I mean, there's the falling apart and then how they can endure. I mean, in the first part, you know, I found myself thinking of, you know, William Butler Yeats, right? I mean, like, you know, this things fall apart, the center cannot hold, right? The best lack all conviction while the worst are full of passionate intensity. You know, there seems something relevant about that now. And yet you make the case for being an optimist in this book. Why?
Yeah, so the more I thought about this, the more I've realized that there's a kind of slightly paradoxical nature to what people think about diverse democracies. So a lot of people, I think, start with a naive optimism, which is understandable, but which I think is misguided. And that's to say, you know, diversity is our strength, and it shouldn't be hard to deal with this ethnic and religious diversity, and how hard can it be tolerant, not to be a bigot, not to be a racist? How hard can it be to, you know, like your neighbor, even if they're a little bit different from you? And that optimism then quickly turns into pessimism, even into fatalism. Mm. Because people can then very quickly say, well, despite the fact that this should be easy, look at reality today, and you have injustice and discrimination and all of these problems. And so there must be something really wrong with us. And so how can we be optimistic about the future if we're doing so badly at this basic task? Why should the future be any better? My movement in this book is sort of opposite. I actually lay out in great detail why it really is very difficult to build these ethnically and religiously diverse democracies. And that, then, I think, can actually help to explain or to motivate a little bit of optimism and a little bit of pride about the improvements that we've made in the last decades. So perhaps let me take a moment to explain why this is a difficult thing to do, and we can talk about the optimism in a moment. There's basically three big reasons for that. The first is that it turns out that human beings really are deeply what Jonathan Haidt calls groupish. But we just have this deep instinct towards building groups and then favoring the members over outsiders. I tell the story, I tell a lot of stories in this book. I tell the story of Henry Teufel, who was a social psychologist. Much of his family perished in the Holocaust, and he tried after World War II to figure out what it is about groups that sometimes makes them so dangerous. What it is about groups that motivated so much of a hatred of World War II. And he thought, hey, I have a great idea for how to figure out what makes these groups tick. I'm going to create groups that are so silly, that are so pointless, that the members wouldn't have a reason to discriminate against each other. And then I'm going to slowly ladle on new features until I get to the point where they start to, where these in-group favoritism, out-group discrimination mechanisms start to kick in. And so he got a bunch of kids from the suburbs of Bristol, where he was a professor in England, into the lab, and he showed them a sheet of paper with about 150 dots on it. And he said, have a guess how many dots on the sheet of paper. And so some students said 120 or 130, and some said, you know, 170 or 180. And he said, great, all right, I'm going to split you into underestimators and overestimators, and then you'll have to distribute points to each other, which can be redeemed for cash. And it turned out that the underestimators discriminated against the overestimators, and the overestimators discriminated against the underestimators. So Teufel failed in what he was trying to do. He failed to create a group that is so silly that this groupishness wouldn't be triggered. Something as silly as splitting you into underestimators and overestimators is enough to bring out this side of human nature. Now, my students sometimes don't believe me that this works, and so I have a little game I play where I ask them whether or not a hot dog is a sandwich. And, you know, my students are an incredibly diverse bunch, which is wonderful. You know, the campus I teach is incredibly diverse now. And they think of themselves as the most tolerant people in the world, and in some ways perhaps they are. But it turns out that the students who think that a hot dog is a sandwich start to discriminate immediately against the students who think that a hot dog is not a sandwich, and vice versa. So this is one difficulty, right? This tendency to form groups and to say, hey, you're part of my group, and I'm going to be really altruistic towards you. I can be capable of great courage and altruism towards you, but you over there, you're in a different group, and I'm going to treat you badly. That is just a deeply human thing, but we can't really escape. So that's the first difficulty. The second is that that kind of groupishness, especially when it comes to ethnicity, to religion, to nationality, to race, has often motivated in the real world some of the worst crimes of humanity. It's not true in every case, but some of the absolute worst instances of war, of civil war, of genocide, of ethnic cleansing, pitted one ethnic, cultural, national, racial group against another. And so we know from history how motivating this can be. And we know that sometimes diverse societies manage to sustain themselves relatively peacefully for decades or for centuries, and then something went wrong, something changed in a constellation, and suddenly people who were peaceful neighbors one day were at each other's throats in the most violent ways the next day. So this is the second difficulty, lessons from history. Now, the third difficulty is that as somebody who passionately believes in democracy, who made his name by warning about dangers to democracy, my instinct was to say perhaps democratic institutions can solve all of this. And I think when you understand democratic institutions in the right way, they can make a real contribution to solving these problems. And I lay out some of that in this book, what kind of democratic institutions can actually help to manage these tensions. But the basic democratic mechanism can also exacerbate them. So when you look at some of the most celebrated democracies in the history of the world, from ancient Athens to the Roman Republic to the city-states of medieval Italy, they often prided themselves on their ethnic purity. Mm. And when you think of some of the places that are most celebrated for sustaining relatively diverse societies from Baghdad in the 9th century to Vienna in the 19th century, they were often monarchies or empires. And that's not a coincidence, actually, because in a monarchy or an empire, you don't have any political power and I don't have any political power. So we both sort of have to trust the monarch. So if you have more kids than I do, or there's more immigrants who come in who look more like you than they look like me, I say, well, I still trust the monarch. It doesn't really change anything. A democracy is always a search for a majority. And so if I used to be in the majority ethnic or cultural or religious group, and suddenly you have more kids than I do, or there's more immigrants coming into your group than to mine, this fear that, hang on a second, I might now suddenly lose the next election, and that might completely change the sort of balance of political power, is kind of natural. It is pushed by the political system. And that helps to explain the forms of demographic fear and doom-mongering in many democracies today. And so you take those three difficulties together and you start to realize that the great experiment is a difficult undertaking, but it is hard to make these ethnically, religiously diverse democracies succeed.
One of the phrases that you use, when talking about the difficulties and the challenges that democracies face, one of the phrases you use is conflict entrepreneurs. And of course, the book can unpack that, because it seems like that's part of the dynamic that, you know, that we need to talk about, whether we're talking about this country, you know, whether we're talking about global situations. I mean, talking about ethnic cleansing and talking about genocide right now, and witnessing what's happening in Ukraine.
Yeah. So one way of thinking about this is that the tendency that human beings have to form these groups and to favor their members, that's universal. That's always there. That's always a danger. But how dangerous that is, the extent to which that drives conflict, really depends on the political context. So let me tell you a story which I think illustrates that quite nicely. A researcher went to study the enmity between two tribes in southeastern Africa, the Chewas and the Tumbukas. And so he went to Malawi, and he went to a Chewa village. And he said, what do you think about Tumbukas? And his respondents, the people he spoke to, had a lot of prejudices. They said, oh, the Tumbukas, you know, the rituals and the dances are all wrong, and you know, they have these weird wedding rites where the newly wed couple goes to reside with the bride's family. That's weird. They should reside with the groom's family. And, okay, so could you ever imagine voting for a political candidate who's a Tumbuka? Or could you imagine marrying a Tumbuka? I said, no, of course not. No, I wouldn't do either of those things. I said, okay, let me see how Tumbukas feel about Chewas. And it turns out they have exactly the same prejudices in reverse, right? So, you know, our dances and rituals are right, theirs are wrong, and obviously the newlywed couple should live with the groom's family, not the bride's family. What are they doing? And no, I wouldn't marry one in a Chewa. I wouldn't vote for a Chewa political candidate. Now, it would have been very tempting to look at this and to conclude that, as journalists like to say, at the time of a sort of Yugoslav civil war, this is a primordial hatred.
Right?
These tribes have always hated each other. They're always going to hate each other. It's very sad, nothing to be done about that. It's just sort of a fact of history. But instead, this researcher did something clever, which is he went from Malawi to Zambia. Now, you have to know that the border between Malawi and Zambia, like so many colonial borders, is arbitrary. It's drawn on a map by somebody who's never even been to the country, right? So these neighboring regions are very similar, and they're just a few miles apart. But he goes to a Chewa village in Zambia, and they're aware of the same cultural differences. Like, yeah, our rites are different, our dances are different in these and those ways. They can describe the differences very well. But they have much more positive attitudes. They say, oh yeah, Tumbukas, I like them, I have nothing against them. They're different from us, but they're very good people. I would marry a Tumbuka if I met the right person. I would vote for one of the political candidates. Why not? And the same when he went to a Tumbuka village in Zambia. So why is this, right? What explains why these two tribes are allies in one country and 10 miles further down the road, they're enemies in a different country? And the answer has to do with politics and with conflict entrepreneurs. In Malawi, these two tribes together make up a large percentage of the population. And so they compete for political power. They normally run against each other in elections. And so if you're a Malawi political candidate and you're a Chewa, you're going to say, well, how do I drive turnout? How do I manage to rile people up? How do I make sure that nobody within my own group defects to the other group? Well, it's by telling people how terrible Trumbukas are and how dangerous they are and how we must mistrust them and all of those kinds of things, right? In Zambia, it turns out that it's a slightly bigger country and it's a more ethnically diverse country. And so Chewas and Trumbukas together are a relatively small percentage of the population. And so they actually are on the same side of a political divide. And so there aren't these conflict entrepreneurs trying to rile up the sentiment against each other. And that's why they end up feeling like we're allies and we can get along. I think the role of institutions and of individual agency in figuring out where the divisions in a society lie are really, really important. And that should teach us some lessons when we think about some of the predictions in the United States that the country is going to become majority-minority or that there's this rising demographic majority for Democrats. I think there's a bunch of things in American politics which actually allow conflict entrepreneurs to divide us in ways that are really dangerous.
So that's, you touched on a couple of things that I think especially interesting to talk about here in California, where we are already a majority-minority state, right? But you have you kind of unpack the terminology and talk about it in ways, I think, that I guess kind of question the validity of that. I mean, in California, the look at saying, there are more Latinos, 39% of the population, 35% white, and et cetera, et cetera. But when you unpack what ethnic identities are and political behaviors mean, you come to some very different conclusions than kind of the conventional wisdom when it comes to majority-minority status and for a country.
Yeah, I don't want to do the terrible thing of telling you about my cab driver, which is sort of a cliche of a, traveling public intellectual. But I arrived in SFO, at 2 p.m. today, and I took an Uber into town to get to my hotel. And when the very nice Uber driver arrived, I saw he had a hat in the colors of a Brazilian soccer team, the Brazilian flag, and on it it said Bolsonaro 2022. and so he was a Brazilian gentleman who's lived in the United States for a long time, goes back and forth a little bit. We had a nice long conversation, and he is a super fan of Jair Bolsonaro. And unsurprisingly, one said, oh, so what do you think about American politics? Well, he's a big fan of Donald Trump's, right? Now, if you know something about Brazilian politics, he thinks of himself as a middle-class Brazilian who actually identifies, I assume, as white within Brazil. In the United States, in the predominant discourse, we'd simply say he's a person of color.
Right.
Right. And that's not how he sees himself. That's not what his political experience has been. It's a really simplified way of trying to understand the sociological reality of the United States today. And if you're assuming that because he's a Hispanic who's a person of color, et cetera, he's going to be voting for Democrats either 20 years from now or today, you're much mistaken because, that Bolsonaro hat and what he said about Trump made me think it's unlikely he's going to be voting for Joe Biden in 2024, right? And so that's, I think, a broader lesson that's really, really important to take. So in the United States, in the political discourse, we have this idea that America will be majority-minority. As the United States Census Bureau predicts, in 2045 or perhaps 2042 or 2048, the exact year shifts, but the basic projection is treated as a scientific fact. And there's this idea that this will really favor Democrats, that there's this rising demographic majority for Democrats because white voters tend to favor the Republican Party and non-white voters tend to favor the Democratic Party. I think this is the one thing that liberals and conservatives, that Democrats and Republicans can still agree on in this country. It's the one really big, ambitious theory about the world that everybody seems to believe across a political divide. And unfortunately, it is not just the one thing that's absolutely wrong, but it's actually a very dangerous idea. So let me explain why. Just empirically, I think it's wrong. If you'd looked at voting behavior in the 1960s, you would have said, Irish Americans, those are a really solid voting bloc for the Democratic Party. So you know, their growth or decline will help predict how the Democratic Party does. Well, today Irish Americans are a really reliable voting bloc for Republicans. So this stuff tends to change over time. And we're seeing a change in real time at the moment. In the 2020 election, the main reason why Donald Trump was competitive is that he significantly increased the share of the vote among every non-white voter group, among African Americans, among Asian Americans, and especially among Latinos. And the only reason why Joe Biden ended up being the legitimately elected 46th president of the United States is that he significantly increased the share of the white vote relative to Hillary Clinton in 2016. So it's just very hard to predict what the voting patterns will be in 2044, 2048. Normatively, that is a good thing, right? It is a good thing for the electorate in the United States to depolarize along racial lines. So I don't want to live in a country where I can look in the audience and I know exactly who you're voting for by looking at the color of your skin. That's not an appealing vision of a kind of country that we should try to build. And, you know, by the way, as somebody who worries about the stability of democracy, it's not surprising that I prefer the Democratic Party at this point to the Republican Party. But the idea that this is somehow a politically positive vision, if in 2048, you know, Democrats narrowly win every election, but there's, you know, 47% of a population, I'd have to vote on the other side, apparently, but if there's sort of 47% of a population that feels really excluded and has a lot of guns, that's not the makings of a stable society. So I think this whole vision is sort of wrong. But I would go even a step further. I think the very idea that America will be majority-minority, or that California today, in a meaningful sense, is California, is majority-minority, depends on accepting the one-drop rule with its roots in the enslavement of millions of people, and then generalizing it beyond the African-American population where it has this historical root to every other group. And that's not how people tend to think of themselves. We have a very rapidly growing mixed-race population that doesn't think of itself as just people of color, but that actually, depending on the exact nature of their parents and the nature of a heritage, has a much more complicated identity than that. We have many Hispanics, like my Uber driver today, who don't think of themselves as people of color in any meaningful kind of way. We have a rapidly growing Asian American population in California and in many other states who see their belonging in this country as complicated, and it's not obvious why we should think of them as naturally being part of a sociological bloc or a voting bloc alongside with African Americans rather than with white voters or with white Americans. So this entire way of talking is just odd. You know, why should we think that an American who has, let's say, French aristocratic family on their father's side, let's say, and Indian Brahmin family on the mother's side, you know, being at the top of their respective societies for a very long time, I mean, coming to the United States and being born here, and I'm sure they might make some experiences of racism, and there are certain ways in which they really face discrimination. But to think that this person is naturally part of this, you know, coherent block of people of color, and falls into the same category as an American who has ancestors, all of whom were brought here in chains and enslaved, it's just a very bizarre way of thinking about reality. And so I think not only should political parties cease thinking in terms of this inevitably rising Democratic majority, but all of us should cease thinking as these two categories as naturally given.
So what's the alternative? I mean, what's your positive vision?
Well, there's two parts of this. So one is political. I think I'm not in the business of giving Republicans electoral advice, but I think it is actually a very good thing if Republicans try to build a genuinely cross-racial working-class coalition, as some people in the party seem to be trying to do, and this to some extent seems to be happening in reality. I think that's a positive thing. And I think Democrats shouldn't give up on some of the predominantly white states that Barack Obama carried in 2008 and in many cases in 2012. So I think our politicians shouldn't function as conflict entrepreneurs who are building on those ethnic divisions in order to win. They should be trying to reach every American. And actually, it turns out that there's a lot of very progressive white people in this country, and there's a lot of very socially conservative so-called people of color in this country. And so if both parties actually try to go after the electorate in the right way, hopefully the electorate will depolarize by race more and more in the coming decades. So that's one important part of this. And the second is that we don't want to build a society in which we have this fundamental division between white and non-white Americans. That is a terrible vision of the future. It is much better if we manage to build something like what the sociologist Richard Alba has called an expanding American mainstream, a society in which people can continue to be true to much of a cultural heritage, in which certain forms of certainly religious solidarity, but also ethnic solidarity might continue to exist, but in which the fault lines of a society are much more fluid and complicated than this division into two mutually hostile blocks might suggest. And ultimately, the goal has to be that our ethnic identity becomes less defining of us, less important of us, not because we close our eyes to some of the real discrimination and racial injustice that exists today, but because we manage to resolve some of it so that these categories come to have less rather than more salience in the future. That needs to be the vision of what a really thriving, diverse democracy would look like.
And yet it seems, I mean, like when you were talking about the, you know, vision of a majority-minority future, you know, if you buy into that and you were going to be on the losing end, then you would want to disenfranchise voters. You would want to diminish what that electorate's going to look like.
Yeah, so this is why this idea is actually dangerous, because it drives a lot of the worst behavior. So it drives, especially on the right and the far right, real attacks on democratic institutions. In 2016, Michael Anton, who went on to be a senior advisor in the Trump White House, wrote a very influential essay called The Flight 93 Election, in which he told sort of movement conservatives why they should get aboard the Trump train. And his most important argument was that because, I quote, of the ceaseless importation of third world foreigners, end quote, the Republican Party would never have a chance of winning and the American Republic would be in danger. And so this is our last chance, right? If we don't put a stop to this in this election, we can give up, he was arguing. And so we don't know that Trump knows how to fly the plane. The plane might crash, but it's worth the risk, right? So this is what this kind of demographic panic leads to. Now, on the Democratic side, it leads not just to the embrace of certain kinds of rhetoric and policy, but actually I think are more likely to divide Americans from each other in ways that are counterproductive and to make our identities less rather than more fluid. But also it leads to really bad electoral calculations, right? In 2016, NPR and the New York Times and all of these news outlets said Hillary Clinton can't possibly lose because of demographics. And a lot of strategists thought all we need to do is to mobilize our base, which they tend to misunderstand because they tend to think that non-white voters are also very progressive voters, and that'll allow us to beat people like Donald Trump. Well, actually, unfortunately, that's not how it works. It turns out, for example, that non-white voters within the Democratic coalition are much more politically moderate than white voters within the Democratic coalition. And so if you want to bring them out to the polls, if you want to make sure that they don't affect the Republican Party, you can't simply say, hey, victory is ours anyway. We just need to mobilize the base, and that way we'll have political power. So if you're trying to make sure that Donald Trump doesn't get reelected in 2024, that kind of lesson is important to heed.
So going from kind of projecting into the future, I want to dip back into the past, because one of the really interesting moments in your book is when you go back to the origin of a profound American metaphor, and tell the origin story of that, which I think many of us just don't know because it evolved. Talk about the melting pot. Mm. Like what really was the melting pot in the beginning? Where did that come from?
Yeah, you know, there's these weird moments when you do research for a book when you realize that sort of, you know, there's a sort of line in the literature and everybody sort of repeats it, but nobody's actually read the thing we're talking about. So everybody says, who talks about this metaphor of how integration might work in the United States, you know, this idea of a melting pot comes from a play by Israel Zangwiler that's, you know, that premieres in Washington, D.C. in 1905. And then we go on to criticize the ideal of a melting pot, and I agree with some of the criticisms, for designing an image of American society that's too homogenizing, for asking people to sort of give up too much of a particularity. And I think there's something to that. I'll come back to that. But you go back to the play, and it actually has a really quite inspiring vision of America, which was, has sometimes gotten lost. So it tells the story of an immigrant called David who suffered terrible pogroms. He survives, but most of his family is killed by essentially Russian soldiers. And he is a composer who's very talented. He comes from the United States and he wants to write the great American symphony that expresses for the first time the sound of a new American man. And he falls in love with a woman who helps him stage the symphony and who helps him sort of settle in America, who's the daughter of a Russian baron who's run away from her family because she has these social ideals and so on. And we become engaged and we're very happy and in love. And then her father turns up to stop her from marrying a Jew. And it turns out that he is, in fact, the commanding officer of the unit that has killed his family. He has these nightmares of his face throughout the play. And when he shows up and there he is, he has the butcher's face. And so he breaks off the engagement because he thinks he can't marry the daughter of a person who's responsible for the murder of his family. And the symphony premieres, and it's a great success, and you know it's clear he's going to have a great career as a composer, but he flees to the roof of a concert hall and is terribly depressed because he feels that he's failed in his vision, that his symphony is expressing this new American man that melts away all the ancient hatreds, but he's not, he hasn't been able to be true to that in his own life. And his ex-fiance comes to congratulate him, and they reconcile. And at the end of the play, he finds this moral strength to say, this history will not stand between us, and we will build a life together despite all of that. So I think that The Melting Pot actually does have this really powerful vision, which isn't ahistorical and unaware of historical conflict and unaware of the difficulties of this kind of project in the way that it's often talked about. It actually is rooted in an understanding of how morally demanding this kind of idea is. And I think it's something that we should connect to, something that we should admire. What David and Vera do is something that deserves our great admiration. But I also think that it's not the right model for what you can expect of everybody. And that the idea of a melting pot was later used in American history to basically ask, tell people, look, we're going to build this American culture which bears the influence of these different kinds of cultures, sometimes in slightly impoverished forms. So, you know, we'll have spaghetti with meatballs and we'll have Kung Pao chicken. But, you know, Italian Americans and Chinese Americans and so on will basically be the same going forward. And that is asking too much homogeneity. It's asking people to give up too much of a cultural heritage. So I agree with criticisms of this as this kind of metaphor for what our society should be like. Now, often that's led to a sort of counter metaphor, an alternative, which is the salad bowl or the mosaic. And that, I think, is also mistaken, because that implies that we're no more than a group of groups or an association of associations. It implies that we will have these completely separate groups living next to each other. And we're kind of bound by a common set of rules to some extent, but there's really no commonality that we're going to have. There's going to be no connective tissue within our society. And that, I think, is also an impoverished vision of what the country might look like, and a dangerous one in terms of keeping the peace over a long period of time. And so I end up suggesting a third kind of metaphor, which is that of a public park. And the idea of a public park is that, you know, if you and I want to continue this conversation after this event and the weather is nice, we can go to a public park near here and say, we're just going to stay among ourselves and have this conversation. But we might also end up being in conversation with other people. We might end up chatting with other people and making these new kinds of connections. And both of those things are our right to do, right? But we might have a preference for a public park in which sometimes these new connections do happen. And that, I think, is the right metaphor for society at large. It's perfectly fine for many Americans to choose to remain within their own groups, to say the most important thing for me is my cultural group or is my religious group, and I really don't particularly want to have close contact with anybody outside of it. I'm going to live a life that is, in that respect, relatively insular. That's one of the rights that you have as an American citizen, and that's perfectly fine. But if everybody did that, if everybody just stayed within their groups, if we didn't have a real dialogue, real communication between members of different groups at all, that, I think, would be a really impoverished vision of our country and quite a dangerous one. And so that's why I think neither the melting pot nor the salad bowl quite work as these metaphors. Something like the public park might work better.
So I think it's telling that it's a public park, right? I mean, this sort of presumes that there has to be buying into the sense of the public good. We are at the Commonwealth Club, right? Finding and being committed to some public good. And so how are we going to make sure there is that space for us to come together? You know, years ago, there was the writer Bahardi Mukherjee did a variation on the melting pot. She talked about the fusion vat. Which was more about the country being transformed, the fusing together of the different identities, and she spoke here in the past as well. Since you talked about the pogroms, I was wondering if we can go back to Ukraine, which is where your grandparents are from originally. I don't know if a lot of folks realize that they were on both sides, both all born near Lviv,
yeah.
Right? Which at the time was part of the Habsburg Empire.
Right, yeah.
So it would have been Lvov in Polish or Lemberg in German, right? I mean, sort of the shifting identities. Obviously, with the fighting that's going on in Ukraine right now, with the invasion that's taken place, I think one of the things that's been part of the conversation here in the U.S., in a positive way, has been the inspiration, and not only the U.S., the inspiration that Ukrainians have offered, and the kind of patriotism that Ukrainians seem to have found. Patriotism is something you talk about in this book, and different kinds of patriotism, not just in the face of war. I mean, where it's an existential matter, right, for Ukraine now, but that there is something to be said for patriotism. That's definitely one of the cases that you make in this book.
Yeah. So look, I'm a German Jew, so patriotism does not come naturally to me, right?
All right.
But a few things have started to change my mind about that and have started to drive home the importance of patriotism to me. You know, one is seeing in the last decades that the kind of hope that I grew up with, that patriotism and nationalism would disappear completely from the political scene, has turned out to be very naive. And that often when decent people didn't speak to patriotism, it was the most dangerous and the worst kind of people who appropriated those symbols for themselves. It's interesting, I'm just thinking of this baseball cap that my Uber driver had displayed in his car, which was, as I had mentioned, sort of in the colors of a national team. Mm-hmm. And he did that. He would always go in the, Bolsonaro in the campaign would always wear the Brazilian football shirt and so on. So if you leave this really powerful symbolism of a nation to extremists, that makes it much more powerful. And that's a real, real danger. So that started to change my mind. And then things like the example in Ukraine changed my mind as well. I mean, we're seeing millions of people voluntarily joining the Ukrainian army to defend their country against this terrible invasion, against this terrible aggression. And that shows that in the worst moments, patriotism can be a really positive and inspiring force. It can be the thing that motivates people to stand up for their ideals and to defend their homeland, and that is a positive thing. Now, it depends, of course, what kind of version of patriotism we're talking about, because Vladimir Putin would also claim to be a patriot, right? And so, for me, there are sort of a number of historical ways of thinking about patriotism, some of which are more appealing than others. So one is an ethnic form of nationalism, right, which says that a true German, a true Italian, a true American is one who has grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-great-grandparents who already lived in that country, or perhaps one who belongs to the majority ethnic group. And that, of course, is something that I reject, that neither has normative significance. I don't think that just the fact that your great-great-great-grandparents belong to some kind of ethnic tribe together should motivate why you treat each other differently today. Nor is it actually empirically accurate in terms of how people now think about themselves. Not just in the United States, but in most democracies, including in Western Europe, where that used to be different, a majority of citizens now recognizes that they have true fellow citizens whose roots are in different parts of the world. So ethnic nationalism should be rejected. The second kind of conception is a civic or constitutional patriotism. And as a relatively newmint American citizen, that speaks to me in a deep way. I was proud in the spring of 2017 to swear to defend the constitutions and the laws of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. One of the things that made me proud to become an American was my love of the Constitution and of the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence. But I also worry that civic patriotism is a little simplistic in its description of what patriotic sentiment actually feels like. One objection I have against it is kind of a little bit philosophical, and it's that patriotism always has to be the love of something specific. It doesn't have to mean, if you're an American patriot, it doesn't have to mean you have to dislike other countries, but it does mean that there's something special you feel about your own country. But political values are, thankfully, not that different between the United States and many other countries in the world. There's many constitutions in the world that are somewhat similar to that of the United States. And even if Austria or Australia tomorrow adopted the United States Constitution word for word, none of you would start to be Austrian or Australian patriots. And so constitutional patriotism doesn't quite explain what's going on here, I think. And more broadly, when most people say they love America or they love their country, they're just not thinking about politics. Most people don't care about politics enough to come to a lecture about diverse democracies when the sun is shining outside on a lovely Tuesday evening. And so to say that patriotism is just about the Constitution, I think, just isn't true to how most people feel. And so I think what we need to add something, we should keep civic patriotism as an important element of what national sentiment means. And it explains why, for example, those sadly relatively few Russians who have been protesting against the war in the last months are true patriots, right? Because they're saying, not in our name, not in the name of our nations. That's an act of true patriotism, to criticize your country sometimes when it needs criticizing as well. So we need civic patriotism, but we need something else as well. And to me, that is an everyday cultural patriotism. But which I don't mean sort of glorifying the past. I don't mean, walking around dressed like the people who walked down from the Mayflower, 400 years ago. It means appreciating what makes up a country today. I think when most Americans say that they love a country, they mean its cities and its landscapes, its sights and sounds and smells, its cultural scripts, the way we interact with each other, the way we speak with each other, its celebrities, even silly things like its TikTok stars. And that is a culture which is forward-looking, which is ever-changing, which is dynamic, and which in a very natural way reflects the ethnic and cultural diversity that makes up the United States and makes up many other democracies in the world today as well. And that, I think, is what people tend to have in mind when they say they love their country. And it's something that is a real strength of many diverse democracies today. And it's something that that we should embrace and recognize more than we tend to.
So here's one of the questions from the audience. Do you believe we're in the midst of a period of political realignment?
Do I believe that we are? Yes, I think we probably are. Moments of political realignment are very confusing. But that does seem to be the case on at least two dimensions. So the first is that, if I'd been tasked 30 years ago, let's say, with figuring out who somebody votes for, and I wouldn't have been allowed to ask them demographic questions, or I wouldn't have been allowed to ask them, do you like Democrats or Republicans? But I would have been allowed to ask them about one kind of policy stance. Mm-hmm. I would have probably asked something like, would you rather have a bigger welfare state and pay higher taxes, or sort of less generous welfare state and pay lower taxes? And broadly speaking, the people who said they wanted a bigger welfare state would have voted for Democrats, and the people who said they'd rather pay less taxes would have voted for Republicans. Today, that question doesn't tell you nearly as much about who somebody is voting for as it would have done 30 years ago. And a much better question might be something along the lines of, do you think that immigration is mostly an opportunity or mostly a risk for the United States, or any set of other kinds of more social and cultural questions? Those tend to be at the beating heart of politics today. Those tend to decide whether you're going to vote Democrat or Republican. So that's an interesting moment of realignment. But then there's a broader sort of set of realignments, including the ethnic coalitions of different political mm-hmm. parties, which I think can be an opportunity. And of course, in the socioeconomic base of political parties. Right? It used to be that more affluent, more educated Americans tended to vote for the Republican Party, and working-class Americans tended to vote for the Democratic Party. Now the Democratic Party, and as Thomas Piketty shows, left-wing parties in many countries around the world, have become the party of highly educated urban elites. And right-wing parties have become working-class parties. And that's a very odd moment of realignment. Now, I think that there I have an ambivalent feeling about it, because mm-hmm. the positive thing about this is that if the Republican Party really does become the party of a multiracial working class, or in ethnic terms, that is an improvement, I think, because it pushes us away from this ethnic polarization. Now, on the negative side, I think as somebody who's always thought of myself as being on the left and so on, there's something really historically perverse if the main left-wing parties just become the parties of all of us in this room, relatively, I don't want to stereotype the audience of a Commonwealth Club, but, of relatively educated, affluent people leading comfortable life in the big cities. That's not the historical mission of the left, and I think there's something sort of really perverse when the left becomes defined by that. And so there's some opportunities in this realignment, but there's also real risks in this realignment.
So having done a book for the centennial of the Commonwealth Club, I also know how the arc of the audience and the perception of it has shifted over the years. There was certainly a time when, I believe it was Juan Williams who said, the Commonwealth Club where Democrats receive little more than cold stares most of the time. Right.
Well, in California, of course, has changed how it votes more than people expect. And this is another thing that's interesting. People always think that electoral maps in the United States are sort of cast in stone, that like they know which states are sort of safe for Democrats or Republicans and which are the battleground states. But it's really interesting to just look through map after map after map after map, from presidential elections one after the other, and you see how much it shifts over time. And I think that's going to continue to shift in the United States. It's not at all clear to me that states which now seem solidly Democrat are going to be solidly Democrat in 15 years and vice versa.
So here's an audience member who wants to know, how does religious fanaticism drive conflict? It's a big question.
It is a big question. Well, let me say a few things about that. I mean, one is that as somebody who's not very religious myself and wasn't brought up in a religious way, I sort of thought that secularization would be a very good thing. That religion drives all these terrible conflicts, and obviously we see that in the Middle East. We've seen that in European history for many centuries. We see that in many parts of the world. And so if only people became less religious, they might become more tolerant. They might become more mutually understanding. And I started to feel a little skeptical about that prediction, because one of the things that religion does also give people is a set of moral standards, is a community to which they're connected, is a stable theology which helps to structure how they behave. And I think in the United States, one of the really pernicious things in the last decades has been the secularization of society, or the form of the secularization of society has taken, which in many cases has meant that people have lost touch with the community. I think it's very connected with the opioid crisis. Right, a lot of the people who suffer most from the opioid crisis are people who really don't have community links at all anymore, and who take opioids in part to switch themselves off. There's this really interesting observation by Andrew Sullivan that the crack epidemic and the and other drugs of the 80s and 90s, including LSD and ecstasy and so on, they tend to be uppers. So they tended to be, I want to go partying with people. I mean, it has horrible effects in the long run, of course, right? But they were actually social drugs. The opioid epidemic is downers. They're lonely drugs, right? They're like, I'm sitting in front of a TV and I'm feeling lonely or I'm feeling depressed and I just want to switch off my mind for 12 hours. And I think that has something to do with the decline of religiosity in the United States and the decline of those kind of communities. And then you see the rise of kind of ersatz religions, right? Some of the people who used to have some kind of stable theology within the church now believe in QAnon and things like that. So I think religious conflict can be terrible, but secularization is not necessarily an answer to that. So that's one kind of way of answering the question. But another thing I want to say is that I have a part of a book where I talk about something that Francis Fukuyama, who I know is going to be a guest here in a couple of weeks, speaks about very, very well. The basic justification of philosophical liberalism as the right basis of our society. The fundamental question we have to ask is, how do we mediate between the level of a state, the group, and the individual? And one part of this is important but obvious. It is to say, well, we need to protect people from the oppressive power of a state, which has gone so horribly wrong in history so many times, and from the tyranny of a majority, which is particularly scary if you're part of a minority ethnic group or a minority religious group, right? So I need to know that I'm able to criticize the president, but also that I'm able to engage in forms of worship that might be really unpopular without having to fear either the state locking me up or a majority of my neighbors coming and saying, how dare you do this? We're going to beat you up, or whatever horrible thing might happen. But there's also a second kind of freedom that we need. And that is the freedom from what Dan Acemoglu and James Robinson have called the cage of norms. Because actually in history, many times, the people who really made you unfree were not members of a different group or members of a state or agents of a state. It was your own group. It was your own parents, your own auntie and uncle, your own religious authorities, your own priest, your own rabbi, your own imam. And so a second kind of liberty that we really need to preserve is liberty from the oppression by your own group. And the only philosophy that can do that is the philosophy of liberalism. Because what it says is that we recognize the importance of religion. We recognize the importance of groups. And that is why we give you individual rights, like the freedom to worship, like the freedom to assembly, which protects your ability to be a member of those groups. But we also recognize that it's individuals rather than groups that are the fundamental building block of our society. Because if you want to leave your group, or if your group coerces you in some kind of way, then it becomes the obligation of a state to step in and to ensure that you can live in a self-determined way. And so I think if you have that in place, that can help to regulate religious conflict, because it means that, as has mostly been the case in American history, this huge variety of religious groups can say, hey, I might not like what you're doing and what worship you engage in and the fact that you haven't seen the light. But you know what? I get to live as I want. And that's important. And we're making sure that no group ends up being so oppressive towards its own members that citizens are subject to its coercion. And having those two things in place, I think, can help to manage conflict between religions, mm-hmm. and can help to make sure that citizens are truly free, even as religious groups flourish.
So you also, you mentioned, at least in passing, you mentioned Robert Putnam and social capital, but a particular kind of social capital, bridging social capital, is being particularly important. Can you talk about that? Why the bridging?
Yeah, absolutely. So one other story I tell in the book is of two cities in India that are very similar to each other, both about two-thirds Hindu and one-third Muslim. But one of them ends up experiencing a lot of what Indians call intercommunal violence, which is to say riots and pogroms with really terrible consequences. And the other city has mostly managed to avoid them. And so why is this the case? What makes the difference between these two places? And it turns out that both of them have a lot of social capital. So both of them have a lot of associations and clubs and trade unions and other things that political scientists have often thought is very good for what a local place is like. But there's this crucial difference, that in one of them, there are separate clubs and associations and trade unions for Muslims and for Hindus. And so when there's a moment of high tension, rumors can spread very easily within these groups, and there's no kind of counterbalancing mechanism. And so then you get all of these conflicts. Whereas in the other city, most of these clubs and associations are integrated. You have Hindus and Muslims who are members of them. And as a result, in moments of high tension, when one group says, you know, oh, I hear that, you know, Muslims have lynched a Hindu boy and, you know, we should go and take revenge. You have people who trust each other who can say, no, we didn't do that. That is untrue. That is a rumor. Let's do something together to stop this from escalating. And so these kind of bridging forms of social capital are really important, and they're really important in our society. It's one of the reasons why in this public park metaphor, we need the connective tissue. We need some people who engage with each other, even if it's okay that other people might not. You know, there's another finding that I talk about in the same chapter that is interesting, which is about what's called intergroup contact theory. Mm. So it turns out that one way to reduce prejudice is to have contact with members of a group against which you might have prejudices. And there's lots of very good evidence of this. In the 1950s, in housing projects in Boston, white Bostonians who had black neighbors ended up having much more positive views about African Americans than white Bostonians who were assigned to segregated housing units. But there's really important conditions on when this works, which are also important to keep in mind. And that is that you have to have equality within the group in that context, that you have to have a common purpose, that you have to have encouragement to see each other as allies rather than as enemies. You have to have all of those kind of basic conditions in place. And that, I think, is an important thing for pedagogy. So a lot of elite private schools around the country now take kids at the age of 10 or 8 or sometimes 6 and put them in these different sort of affinity groups. So there's teachers coming in saying, you're Asian American, you're African American, you're Latino, you're white, you're going to go into these separate groups to discuss about challenges you experience and to sort of give you a political self-understanding. Now, I understand where it comes from, because many of these kids do experience real forms of discrimination and racism and so on. But I worry that this completely misapplies what we know about human psychology, but it precisely encourages these kids to say, this is my group and I'm going to treat members of it better and discriminate against members of the out-group, right? If kids do that along the lines of whether they believe that a hot dog is a sandwich or not, they're definitely going to do that if you take kids in these elite private schools and say, this is the white group, and we're going to talk to you as the white group. The idea might be to turn them into anti-racists, but I think it's more likely to turn them into racists than into anti-racists. What's much better if you trust the research, which is a very deep research program on intergroup conflict theory, is something much more classic. Put them on a sports team together. Right? So you have common interests. You identify together as members of this arbitrary group of the sports team that's competing against the other sports team. But within that, you're equal, and we're encouraging you to see each other as peers, to compete together for this goal. And that is much more likely, I think, to lead to real conversation, to real mutual understanding, and then hopefully to better political outcomes.
And actually, so it's funny, you mentioned sports, and you've talked about sports and sports crowds in connection with your mother, which has a very different, had a very different impression of what sports are and what and the dangers of them.
Yeah, so, you know, when I was growing up in Munich, I was a fan of Bayern Munich. We're really growing up in the center of town, and so often on game days, there's these, you know, groups of fans walking down the street, and this always made my mom very, very nervous. Because I think she recognized this groupishness as one of the motives of terrible conflict, and to her, it reminded her of the Holocaust, it reminded her of World War II, it reminded her of all the terrible things that human beings can do to her. So she would sort of, when I was little, make me cross the street when we saw these sort of fans coming the other way. And I understand that concern. Groups can turn violent in these kinds of ways. But I also have made my peace with the fact that we're never going to be able to get rid of groups entirely. So the mission for America, for example, is not to say, how do we overcome groups entirely? How do we have a melting pot where we just think of each other as individuals that are sort of equal to each other? That's not going to work. What we should think of is, how do we have a multiplicity of group identities? How do we have group identities that don't drive us into deep conflict? Mm-hmm. How can I say that, I might be, you know, have a connection to Mexico culturally, and that's important to me. But I also have a particular religion, perhaps I'm Catholic, perhaps for some reason I'm Muslim, and that's important to me. And also, I'm an American, and that's important to me, and that connects me to people who have a different color of skin, who have a different kind of religion. And so I think the ideal is to create a society in which we're going to have these different thriving groups. Many people will identify strongly with a cultural heritage, will identify strongly with a religious faith, will identify perhaps, in some cases, strongly with ethnicity. But they also have points of commonality with most of their fellow citizens. They also have a common identity as Americans. They also have a way of saying, even as we recognize those differences, there's something important that we have in common and that unites us.
So I have to say, as just in coming back to sports teams, since I'm from Chicago originally, I grew up as a Cubs fan. And for years, I had the feeling that rooting for the Cubs was like rooting for world peace, right? It wasn't necessarily ever going to happen, but it was the right thing to do. Someone online wants to know, how can the left project a more optimistic, inclusive message that reflects American tradition?
Well, let me talk perhaps a little bit about the reasons for optimism, which are important, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the weird things at the moment is that you have a fashionable pessimism which often unites the right and parts of the left. So when it comes to an issue like immigration, California has a lot of immigration, you have people on the far right who will basically say, Italian and Irish immigrants 100 years ago worked out well because of the cultural similarities to the majority group in the United States, or perhaps even because they were somehow ethnically different. And immigrants who are coming to the country today from El Salvador and Mexico and Vietnam and Kenya and other places, they're, the far right says, not going to succeed, and they're not succeeding, because there's supposedly something inferior about them, culturally or even ethnically. Now, a lot of the left is going to reject, rightly, that attribution of blame and say that's ridiculous, there's nothing inferior about people coming from those countries. but it'll actually echo a lot of the pessimism. What I hear from a lot of my friends is, well, it's true that Irish and Italian immigrants could succeed 100 years ago because they were white, and these new groups of immigrants today that are non-white are discriminated against in such extreme ways that they're never going to succeed. And so, you know, the current state of America is deeply unjust, and there's not going to be any progress. Now, there is discrimination and there is injustice, and we have to be upfront about that. But the best studies actually show that immigrants today from all of those countries are rising the socioeconomic ranks, are gaining higher degrees, are making more money at about the same rate as Italian and Irish immigrants did a century ago. Often in the first generation, opportunity is limited, perhaps even language acquisition can be limited, but the generations of the children, the grandchildren of immigrants are succeeding at about the same speed as the children and grandchildren of Irish and Italian immigrants did 100 years ago. Now that obviously shows, unsurprisingly, that the far right is wrong to say there's something inferior about the immigrants coming to our country today. But it also shows that my friends on the left are too pessimistic when they say that there's just no chance for them to succeed. And so that's just one little important point where there can be a kind of addiction to just talking about the negative sides. And I understand that, right? Because you want to have open eyes about the injustices we see in the country today. And you want to have open eyes about what we need to do to make the country more just. And all of that is fine. But when that leads to an unwillingness to recognize that we've made progress, then we don't have a positive vision of a future to offer. And that's when it becomes easy for the far right to win. Because when you have a competition between a vision of a future that's really pessimistic and you get to blame others, or it's a vision of a future that's really pessimistic and you have to blame yourself, well, it's easier to blame the others. Mm-hmm. And so for me, this goes back to what I was saying earlier, that if you start with naivety about the project of building these diverse democracies, it's easy to fall into deep fatalism. But when you start with a recognition of how difficult it is, how cruel American history has been, how cruel the history of so many other diverse societies has been, if you recognize the fact that 30 years ago, a majority of Americans thought that interracial marriage was immoral, then you can also see that we've made tremendous progress in the last decades. You can see that America today is a much better place than it was 50 or 25 years ago. You can celebrate the fact that now the number of Americans who think that interracial marriage is immoral is down to the single digits. But we used to have about 1 in 33 newborns were interracial. Now we have about 1 in 7, or 1 in 6, according to some statistics. That the situation of African Americans has significantly improved over the last 50 years. And so, you know, the way to have a more effective political message on the left is to be true to our universalist values, to be forthright in our condemnation of injustices that exist, but also forthright in our celebration of the progress we've made, and to embrace a vision of a future that most people would actually be excited to live in.
And yet there's, I think it's in, is it in the People versus Democracy, your previous book, where you point out that among older Americans, many more believe in the importance of living in democracy, whereas among millennials, it's a dramatic drop-off in terms of the stress of importance of living in a democracy.
Yeah. So look, I think that some of that has improved because younger people can now recognize the importance of living in a democracy because they feel it is threatened in a way that wasn't true a few years ago. But yeah, this is one of, you know, I talk a lot about demography isn't destiny, but age isn't destiny either. So there's always this idea that the left has in Britain and the United States that, you know, young people are much more progressive than older people. And so, you know, once older people die out and the young people are in the majority, then everything will be great politically. That never pans out because people become a lot more conservative as they age. And the nature of political debates change and so on. So certainly I think you can't just say, oh, everything will automatically become better. I also worry a lot about the political sphere, right? So my last book was about the danger that we saw for a time, populist post to democracy. And now my new book is about how to build diverse democracies. And the message of the last book was relatively pessimistic. The message of this book is relatively optimistic, and that can seem like a contradiction. But it's not, because two things have changed. The first is the conventional wisdom. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the last book, the conventional wisdom in my field in political science as well as in the public was, you don't have to worry about the future of American democracy at all. You can fast forward by 25 or 50 years, and America will always be a democracy. There's just no reason for concern. And that was a deep mistake, because American democracy is under threat, because you can never assume the democratic systems will endure in that kind of way. But now we've gone too far in the other extreme. We've gone into saying American democracy is definitely going to collapse, or it's so dark that there's no progress to be made. And I think that's also overly pessimistic. So partially I'm responding to a change in the conventional wisdom. But the other way of putting it is that I'm actually quite optimistic about the changes in the heart of American society in the last decades. I think America today, when you actually look at what the country is like sociologically, when you go into the heart of a country, when you look at how much more diverse the top echelon of American society is, when you look at how much more tolerant Americans are on average, it is clearly a better country than it was 50 or 25 years ago. When you look at the political level, it's really, really screwed up. And I continue to worry very much about the 2024 election, about the 2028 election, about the way in which Donald Trump is trying to undermine the process of certification of the election, about what he would do if he was reelected to office. So one way of thinking about the current state of American politics is that there's this terrible cultural civil war of the American elites, which might be imposed on the rest of society, in which case we really might fall apart. And we need to use the strength of our society and the positive developments in our society to build a positive vision that's going to allow us to ensure that this doesn't happen.
So here's an audience member that offers this. Can you imagine a major transformative project over 3 to 5 years to reform our politics and governance instead of incremental reforms or a slow change in values? A collaborative society-wide project done well could bring us together.
So I talk a little bit about the Chapter 10 problem in this book. So the Chapter 10 problem, with all due respect to all the other distinguished invitees at the Commonwealth Club, is probably true of at least half of the people who speak here, right? And certainly half of the great nonfiction books that are published. And it's basically that for 9 chapters, or for, you know, 9/10 of a presentation, you explain some deep problem in the world and explain, you know, why it's important, why it's urgent, why it's really hard to deal with. And then you say in the 10th chapter, hey, here's the solution, right? Here's what we're going to do about all of this. And that solution goes wrong nearly always in one of two ways. Either it says, here's the 3 little incremental things that we might be able to get done. And you think, yeah, perhaps we can do 2 out of those 3 things, even though our politics is so screwed up, but those are far too little for us to actually be effective, right? It's not going to solve the scale of a problem. Or you say, hey, here are the absolutely radical changes we're going to make in order to solve the problem. And then you say, look, yeah, perhaps if we make all of these absolutely radical changes, we might be able to solve this problem. But A, it probably leads to other problems. And B, I know what Congress is like. This is never going to happen. What are you talking about? Right? And so I thought hard about how I might be able to avoid the Chapter 10 problem in this book. And my answer is that you need to build on the positive changes that are actually happening in society. So I don't think that I have come up with the silver bullet, that if only we pass this law in Congress, that's what's going to help us deal with diverse democracies. I have a friend who wrote a review of my book. It's a little strange that he wrote it, because he knows me a little bit too well to write a review, but never mind. But he basically said, he writes about, when you hammer, everything you see is a nail, right? And so he always writes about how proportional representation is much better than our electoral system. And so he said, look, really this book should have said that if we only adopted a system of proportional representation, that would solve the problems of diverse democracies. Now, that came as a surprise to me because the book has also been published recently in Germany and the Netherlands, which has systems of proportional representation. And when I was in Germany and the Netherlands, somehow nobody in the audience said, oh, this is a really interesting book, but you know we have a system of proportional representation, right? So this isn't a problem here anymore. In fact, they are dealing with very similar problems, and none of them think that their electoral system is a solution to it. So I don't know whether there's a silver bullet or whether I have the silver bullet to offer. But there are important background conditions that make it easier. And some of the most important ones is to have economic prosperity. It's much easier to feel positively about your neighbor, even if he perhaps has a bigger car than you or his house is a little bit nicer than yours, and even if he's from a different group. If you feel like you're doing well and your future is going to be better, you have to have universal solidarity. So you have to have a welfare state that ensures that everybody has a decent life if things go wrong and that doesn't pit people against each other along the lines of ethnicity. You have to have an inclusive and effective political system. We have a sense that actually when you're passionate about something and you agree with the majority of your citizens, that's going to have an impact on the kind of policies that you have in your country. And you have to have a public discourse of mutual respect in which you understand that you can have reasoned disagreements about important issues and that your opponents aren't just terrible human beings. And so I think we can try to encourage those background conditions. But really my optimism doesn't come from this is what Congress is going to do or this is what the Supreme Court is going to do. It comes from we've made real improvements in the last decades and we can continue to build on those improvements to build a better society.
So we have, we've reached the point where we have time for just one more question. And I'd like to come back to the very beginning, your dedication for this book, to friendship. Why?
Hmm. Yeah, I think it's something like I played around with different formulations of it, and I forget which one I ended up going with. It's to friendship, civic and personal, or something like that. I think something along those lines. Because ultimately, to make a diverse democracy work, personally, because friendship is one of the great things in life, and having a great conversation with a friend, having that mutual trust, having the ability to call each other out when you do something bad, but from a place where you know that you're always going to be there for each other. That's one of the great joys in life. So there's personal friendship that I want to dedicate it to. But civic friendship is just as important. Because we need to get to a place, and to some extent we are at a place where in a country like the United States, somebody who's Asian American in San Francisco and somebody who's a white steel worker in Michigan and somebody who's, an African-American in Boston, feel a sense of kinship with each other. Say, look, we have differences to each other. We might invest a lot of importance in our own communities. But you know what? At the Olympics, we're going to cheer for the same team. And, when the chips are down and somebody like Vladimir Putin wants to invade, we're actually going to defend the values of our country and the culture of our country together. And despite our differences, we actually have ways in which we're also similar. And I think celebrating and encouraging that kind of civic friendship has to be the basis for making diverse democracies like the United States work.
Well, our thanks to Dr. Yasha Monk, author of the new book, The Great Experiment, for joining us today. The Great Experiment's available here and everywhere books are sold. We'd also like to thank our audience here and our audience watching online. If you'd like to watch more programs or support the Commonwealth Club's efforts in making both virtual and in-person programming possible, please visit commonwealthclub.org/events. Thank you and stay safe, everyone.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.